Deer Valley's The Brass Tag Restaurant is pleased to support KPCW. The Brass Tag, located in the lodges at Deer Valley, is open nightly from 3 to 10 p.m. and serves a full dinner menu from 5:30 to 9 p.m., offering brick oven cuisine and a full bar. 649-1000 or deervalley.com.
Mark Miller Subaru is proud to sponsor the Sundance Reel on KPCW, an independent film at Park City Film Series. Mark Miller Subaru supports the community through our nonprofit partnerships and helps protect the environment with our green initiatives. Located on South State Street in Salt Lake City and Southtown in Sandy, offering a wide selection of new 2016 Subaru and pre-owned vehicles. Love the experience at markmillersubaru.com.
And welcome back to Sundance Weekend, our second hour here. I'm here with David Darcy, a critic from Screen Internet.
International.
Yes. We have a documentary in the festival this year called Holy Hell, and the director here, Will Allen, at least purportedly your name is Will Allen, is that right?
That is my given name, yes.
Yeah, that sounds like you're a contestant on To Tell the Truth or something. it is about a person's, your experience with a cult community, but we'll kind of let you tell the story from this point, because there's certain things that you don't want to give away to an audience, or and certain things maybe, I don't know which things we can talk about at this point. But you start at square one and tell us where this started.
Well, I mean, I was a filmmaker since I was young, and I went to film school in Texas. And right after film school, I was pretty much confused about what I wanted to do with my life. Like, I think you're supposed to be, but I didn't know you're supposed to be. So I had a big life ahead of me, and I wasn't sure how to be happy with it. And my sister introduced me to her meditation teacher at the time. It was 1985, and no cell phones, no internet. And I was very interested, and I loved it. We sat and meditated and talked about not being an ego, not being yourself, not being these things you think, and trying to find something deeper and much more beyond our confusion. And we had immediate results. And when you start having an experience that you can't deny, you start pretty much investing in it because it's something that's helpful. So the first few years were very, very transformative and opened me up to so many things in life and, you know, the universe and stuff like that. So that was my beginning. It was one of those things that it evolved very slowly without us being aware of it. And how that happened was our philosophy was being in the moment, like being awake and aware in the moment, every moment, here, now, right? And that's like eternal. So because every moment just keeps continuing, we were encouraged to remain around each other all the time and around the teacher all the time. And we create a little society around that, reminding each other to be in the moment, to be here. But what happens is there was no exit strategy. There was no graduation. There was no just do this for a couple years, and then you can go. The teacher was very controlling. He got much more, you can't go out without, you can't go away from this and maintain this. You have to remain with us and with me. And we all pretty much agreed that that was kind of like true. We were in that group think where it became us and them, like the outside world could not understand us, what we were doing, and we no longer identified with the outside world. We create our own way of thinking, our own vocabulary, our own subculture, our own pop culture within our culture. I mean, we had a whole community of 100 people that kind of fulfilled the world for us, in a sense that if we thought we were escaping the world, like, oh, I don't want to deal with that, all those people were in the group. Okay, so we didn't escape anyone. We couldn't avoid anything. We had to deal with all of our personalities. So that's not something you can escape in a small community. It's something that it's controlled, and you all work together to go beyond those things. And so it's very supportive to get past any kind of problems you might have with yourself or other people, right?
Yeah. We're talking about the title of this doc is Holy Hell. And if any of you listening grew up in Utah, you might think that that has something to do with the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. Or you might think it has to do with Utah itself. But talk about the coercive role that sex played in this community.
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's a complicated question because sex was something that the teacher was teaching us to transcend, that sex was a lower energy, and for you to find those exalted states of enlightenment, you have to let that energy rise up to your crown, you know, the head. And so we were all trying to abstain and avoid sex, and that was his teachings for a long time. What was happening behind closed doors was pretty much that the teacher was, again, elevated himself to that status of do what I say, not what I do. You know, when you get to where he's at, you don't have to do that anymore. This is kind of what he told me. And you get to a point where that doesn't matter. And you can now be in those sexual places. So it was very confusing because he would only do that with a few people behind closed doors under very secret circumstances.
So it's you know, I have to say with, you know, the Oscars coming up and Spotlight being one of the films nominated, mm-hmm. it's sort of like what the Jesuit priest said when I was in Jesuit school, is sex is totally wrong unless it's sex with me.
Yes. Well, that's what it was. That was the message I got. Right. But nobody, I don't know what other messages people got because I wasn't in their skin in their private moments with him. This is why I made the film. When the whole thing ended and everything was so confusing and so many truths were coming out and so many lies were coming out, we all dealt with it in different ways. We all departed and we broke up our community, and we and how I dealt with that was to kind of come to understand that this happened to a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. He worked with every person differently, and women were also abused, but not sexually. There's a lot of abuse that can happen in this kind of role play with a teacher, and there's a teacher and a student, which he used to say, I'm not a teacher and you're not a student. I'm a master and you're a disciple. It's even deeper relationship than a teacher because it's not knowledge he's giving you, it's experiential knowledge. So it's something you have to catch.
How did you identify yourselves? I mean, did you say we are a self-realization group or we are a religion or?
No, we tried not to identify ourselves. That was part of our charm, is we didn't want to become an organized anything. And we thought we were just special, just a group of friends. We really never saw ourselves as a cult. But what creates a cult is having a leader that has complete power and control. So we slowly identified ourselves as, like you said, a group of people going for spiritual enlightenment. And we also named ourselves the Buddha Field, which is a name he borrowed from another group, which we didn't know about. But, but we found out later that that was also borrowed. Yes, I apologize.
But the one thing that I found distinctive. One thing I found distinctive about this cult is that the role that appearance played, the self-selected people, if we can call them that, were almost uniformly attractive. Mm-hmm. And there was a real emphasis on making oneself even more attractive,
yeah.
whether it was from, you know, diet, exercise, mm-hmm. or plastic surgery. And, you know, this is in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Started in Los Angeles.
Started in Los Angeles, right, where one isn't surprised by that kind of self-beautification.
Right, because it's Hollywood.
But it is. But the rhetoric is seeking to undermine superficiality.
Right.
So, you know, I guess if we were talking about the contradictions and hypocrisy of religious cults, that would, you know, lead us down a lot of familiar paths. But what distinct – you must have looked at people – you know, most people I know who've been in cults describe having looked at people in other cults and said, "Oh God,
I would
how
never
stupid! How can they fall for that?"
Right, I know.
Did you say these sorts of things?
Well, we're in it.
Yeah,
not at the beginning. No, at the beginning, you know, it was all very normal feeling. It just got extreme, more extreme and more extreme, because the teacher, I think, had more free rein to be himself. His vanity and he came from another country, Venezuela, which is very focused on plastic surgery over there. But how he would turn it to us, it wasn't like, oh, you have to be beautiful or you have to look better. It was delivered like this. your outer experience should reflect your inner experience. So if you're experiencing God and you're experiencing all this love and beauty, your outer should express it. So he would have the girls put on makeup and put on eyeliner and make your hair blue. It just started off very small, like, wear prettier clothes. Why are you wearing black? You know, is that what you feel? You feel black inside? And they were, no, I'll wear flowers. And so he was always pushing people in that direction. I think that's where it started. And then it got extreme because he was an extreme personality.
And he was using more makeup than all of them combined.
Exactly. Yes, he was.
Okay. You know, we're having this conversation, everybody who's listening, to avoid giving a lot of this away, because this film tells its story, there are all sorts of jaw-dropping developments in it that we don't want to deprive you of the surprise of. But you, how much footage did you have of this? And how long did it take you to edit it?
Yeah, editing was hard. But over 20 years, I was shooting during that period of time. I was documenting our group, and I'd make documentaries just for our group, just for our 100 people. And I'd edit them, and I'd pretty much discard all my extra leftovers.
Well, that's too bad.
Yeah, well, I know, but it would have way too much footage, believe me. But so I was left with about 35 hours of cut footage and verite footage that I hadn't cut, and interview footage with him. And I had made a documentary with interviews of my friends in 1990 that no one saw. That so I've been documenting this for a long time, but again, we had to edit this in the last period of time down to 100 minutes from about 35 hours of cut footage. Yeah. Footage.
And how were you able to get away with this? If I were a cult leader, I think one of the things
you're not a cult leader?
Well, only in this room. But the last thing a cult leader would want is an eager beaver disciple with a video cam.
Well, you know, that was interesting, because that was a jaw-dropping moment for me, was to realize that he was letting me film all of this, but I found out later that he didn't trust me. And so he kept his enemies very close to him. And so if anyone wanted to leave the group, he would try to confiscate everything they had. Well, I realized later that I was probably the worst enemy he had and the last person he'd ever want to leave, because I knew everything. And so I think he kept me there way stronger. He had a much stronger hold on me and manipulated things to keep me there for much longer because of that. And I do truly believe that now.
Instead of capturing the Freedmen, it's the same, like capturing the Buddha camps or something.
It's funny that a friend of mine went to India after this and had met another, a real guru, or Indian guru, who's considered authentic. And he was talking about our guru, and he said, well, my guru wears false eyelashes and, you know, makeup. And the other guru in India goes, well, you know what they say, false eyelashes, false guru. And that was his comment. And it was like, yeah, you know, but no one taught us that. We didn't know that. And this all happened on our own. We created this in a weird way. It's like a social experiment. Years later, we look at it like, wow, this all happened so fast. And there was no one directing it except him.
Why? Explain the susceptibility of the people who were in this group.
I think the longer you commit to something that you put your time and energy into, it's really hard to pull yourself away from, especially if it's a strong belief. And then when you build a community of people you have all these deep emotional bonds with, they become your family, and they also become your family because you've isolated yourself from everyone else. And so they become your family. You're working with them. You have business. You're living with them. It's really hard to leave, because there's the teacher who's creating conflict that he's supposed to be, because he's supposed to be the teacher. So we all kind of accepted that conflict as if part of our growth. And then there's a community that's bonding together, having the same experience together. And that bond is really strong. And I think that's what I learned after finishing this film, that it wasn't so much about the teacher as much as it was about us, and a lot about, that's what we get to take with us. That's what we get to keep.
That sounds like the observation of a person who's been through psychotherapy.
Yeah, but I gave it to myself. So I came to this realization on my own. That realization, I have other realizations I have tons of help with. But no, that one, I see that was the lasting thing. The other stuff is too ethereal.
But this goes back to my question. What can you identify about the susceptibility? I mean, what's going to happen is, okay, you take this film around, and people are going to be extremely interested in this thing, because it has... Part of the look from the earliest footage is a kind of gauzy television look from that time, with people who look like actors, who look very, very attractive people. What if you can generalize, what got these people to the point where they could be taken advantage of in such an extreme way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I was looking into when I interviewed everybody, and that's what I was trying to find out, because I figured we all had our own individual experience with that. And we did, and it's a hard one to answer for everybody. But I would like to say that I think we were all very trusting. There was a certain trust in everybody. We all had an idealistic part of our personality that wanted something we really believed was possible, that we heard in all of the 70s and the 60s, just because it was over, we really weren't happy with that, with the Reagan period, and we all wanted something much more rich and deep. And I think everyone individually was looking for either community that made them susceptible, like they had no community or family, or they were looking for something deeper beyond drugs, you know, not a drug. Because people go into drugs or anything to try to find something beyond their ego, something that they can escape from themselves. And so one of the things he taught me, one of the things I heard the very first meeting was, like, drugs are used, is this a temporary thing? You can't depend on that. You have to find an organic way. The drugs are just tapping into something for you. You need to find that organically. And I'm like, okay, I want to find that organically. So that's what made me susceptible. And then if I have any part of my personality that's an addictive personality, if I have any part of myself that's codependent or insecure, well, all those things are going to be keep adding to my susceptibility. If someone's giving me value, if the teacher's offering me value or I'm not getting anywhere else, that's going to add to my susceptibility. I need him now. He is that source of information that I don't have, and he becomes value. And so I think all those things combined make people susceptible to bad relationships. I mean, look at this like a bad relationship, you know, or one that started off good and ended up bad. I mean, people stay in those relationships way too long.
Okay, you'd been shooting, right, that's for sure. You'd been shooting this for many, or compiling the footage for many, many years. When did this actually become Holy Hell? When did you start working on this as a feature doc, and who knew that you were working on it? Did anybody try to stop?
No, no one tried to stop me because I didn't tell anybody. Except people I trusted who wanted me to make it. I was at Sundance in 2012, and I was coming here, and my partner had told me to come and just reintroduce yourself into the film world. You know, you've been in a cult for 20 years, and you're a filmmaker, and come out, and just come out of the cult, and just come out. And so I'm like, oh, God. So I came to Sundance and wanted to see if I fit in, you know, wanted to see if this was a community of people that I could resonate with, because I'd been so gone for so long. Yeah. And they were, and I just saw all these beautiful artists who were passionate about their work and doing important things and supporting each other.
Which year was this?
2012. Mm. Yeah, and that year, I had done all the festival, and I'd done everything, and I felt very connected to everyone, and I just felt very happy that it was not something outside of me. It wasn't, like, far away. It was, like, everyone's doing it. And so I saw some films that really moved me, and by the end of the festival, Tracy, my co-producer who was in the group with me, for 20 years, and she helped me produce all my movies in the group. She was talking to me, and she said, you know, they have a documentary funding foundation. You should just try to do something. And I was like, you're right. And we had 10 days. I left Sundance. I had 10 days to make my first trailer and my submission, and interviewed six of my friends and put a 10-minute trailer together about what happened, and I submitted my first, and that's when I decided to do it.
Yeah,
because I got such a strong reaction.
Sundance might put this out, you know, come to Sundance and find yourself.
Yeah, right. It's not that easy.
You know, it's a little suspicious. That,
sure. It's not that quick.
Well, or come to Sundance and find yourself doing something else besides buying an Acura car that's on the corner.
And some of the descriptions of the foundation do sound, I mean, there is this kind of charismatic, overwhelming leader, mm-hmm. Redford, and you meet in a secluded location in a canyon, and
right. I'll be meeting Robert soon, apparently.
Is there a how-to or a prescriptive element to what you wanted to achieve here? There are Will Allens who are now 20, 21 years old, uh-huh. who are as lost as anybody, as we all are susceptible to some kind of charisma and looking for guidance.
We should all be able to get help. We all have to teach. I mean, we don't come here fully formed, right? We have to learn. And there's different institutions that are built on learning. The four-year college system, I think, is great. I think a four-year life system would be great, or a one-year or something planned. I think that when I look at a 22-year-old or myself as 22, I don't think I could have told myself everything I know now then. I couldn't have said to myself, you don't need to do that. Don't do that. Or just do it here and get out there. I don't know. I can't. No one can really do that with their life to kind of rewrite it. But I also know I can't tell people to skip. You can't jump forward. You can't just skip your life. You have to live your life, and this is where you're going to get your experience. So choose carefully what you want to do, how you what you want to what you want to.
Okay, should these young Will Allens or we could use whatever name they decide
Wilma,
to call themselves.
Wilma, there's yeah, females
Wilma,
out there.
Wilma Allen, okay, Wilma. And the would-be Wilmas, yeah. That's even a bigger thing now, okay? Should these people be suspicious if they see the would-be guru?
Yes, they should.
Looking in the mirror 12 hours a day.
They don't see that, though. They don't see that.
You saw that.
I did, but that was only after I was around him for, you know, 84 years. Most people don't. All they get to see is the first impression that they give. See, I would drive him everywhere. I was his chauffeur. He would yell at me in the car on the way to a spiritual meeting, right? He would scream at me, you slam the door, don't drive so fast, slow down. I'm like, oh my God, I'd almost be in tears. And we'd walk into this meeting, and all these people had been meditating for, you know, 30 minutes waiting for him.
Did he yell at them?
No, God, no. He walks up there glowingly and says, namaste. And they all go, namaste. And I'm back there going, what an asshole, you know, because I hate him, because he's just yelling at me. So I mean, no one gets to see that. That's the stuff that you just kind of have to drop your mind, which is another famous phrase from our
okay,
life.
What if you see the as
I do want to answer your question.
Okay, but what if you see the false eyelash on his cheek?
you tend to accept things pretty quickly. You tend to come to terms with who people are pretty quickly and accept them. At least a lot of people I know did. But this is what I would say to young people or anyone, especially now. I think people are way more savvy about people being an autonomous truth person who's going to give you all the everything. Never always have a always be able to leave. Never commit. Always, it's your journey. You can always step out and walk away. That's what you need to know. He got us to commit. He got us to make promises and vows. Those are really hard if you're a loyal person to give up. You know, people have that happens in churches and people in all these cults and religions. They're all committed to some reason. They believe it's the right thing to do. Don't make any promises that you're going to be stuck with that you can't get out of. That's my main thing, because I have people getting in it now. They're like, what should I do? I'm like, make sure you know where the back door is and get out.
That's what somebody said to me about buying real estate.
Well,
but I think I look, I, you've
been,
might, you've
might not
been
be
there.
The best advice. I'm just saying I don't want to tell people not to have their own journey, whatever that might be. But don't follow a teacher. I would just say don't follow a single person. It's ridiculous.
There's a potential I see here for a feature remake.
Yeah,
there's so much personality.
Right.
There's so much these interviews. It's funny because we just came off an interview about James Foley, and there's moving testimony from the hostages who were there with him, and in a way, this is hostage testimony too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What you're showing, and amazingly revealing comments about what happened between these individuals mm-hmm. and the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that there's a lot that's left in this story to explore in a dramatic way.
Right. Do you have some idea what the effects of this will be? I presume the teacher is out there someplace and he's in a you know
he has ears on all of this.
Is he in the green room?
I hope not. I'd love him to sit down and have an interview. It'd be awesome. But you know he will never commit himself to something like that that he can't be in complete control of.
Okay, what's the status of this film? Is it for sale here? Are you looking for a distributor?
Yes, we are. Actually, we came here looking for a distributor.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the if they haven't seen it already, the first showing for Holy Hill is again small irony alert the Temple Har Shalom Theater on Monday at noon, Tuesday. Tuesday at the Sundance Resort. Remember, watch out those secluded locations in the canyon. Remember, watch out for those. And gets back Wednesday at the Library Center Theater in Park City, and Thursday Redstone Cinema, and some further showings at the Library Center Theater, and finally down at the Salt Lake City Library Theater. So, Will Allen, the director of Holy Hill, and the guy who lived it. Thank you for being here.
Right. And if you're going to burn in hell, the first few years are better than what it ends up being.
Yeah. Exactly. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Richard Bizarro.
And I'm Rick Redford with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
We take pride in over 45 years of service to our community. We are committed to safe, reliable, and comfortable travel for our guests.
Reservations available at allresort.com or at 649-3999.
We move people.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Being a member of the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business and provides a wide array of benefits. We promote your business, provide networking and educational opportunities, and even have benefit programs for you and your employees. For more information, visit us online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Me for the TED Radio Hour, Sunday mornings at 10, right here on KPCW. Each episode takes you on a journey through the world of ideas with riveting speakers from the renowned TED stage. The show is the fastest-growing program in public radio history, and it's on Sundays at 10 a.m. on 91.9 and 88.1 FM, KPCW.
Brought to you in part by Park City Film Studios and Crandall Capital.
Cinder.
You have your own until somebody comes.
Okay, and it's time for our yearly segment of Industry Talk. We're here with co-host David Darcy and a couple of people that Dave knows intimately well.
Yes, well, let me introduce them. Bob Burney, former head of many distribution entities, and it would take us more than this segment to list his distinctions. But Bob, give me your title at Amazon right now.
Head of Marketing and Distribution at Amazon Studios.
Okay. And John Sloss, also lawyer, sales mogul, I guess. Can we call you that, John?
As long as I don't call myself that, yes.
Okay. And how else do you want to identify yourself, John?
I'm in the service business. We have a company called Synetic Media, which is there to sort of help filmmakers get their films made and out into the world.
Okay, and the other guest is a woman I would describe as the late Ann Thompson. And how do you want to identify yourself? Again, there's a million ways to do that, but please talk right into the mic.
I am a constantly evolving being. And
you should have been on the Herzog segment.
I was listening. I was listening, and I was going, what the hell is he saying? And I'm interviewing him tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to it. IndieWire has been bought by Penske Media, and I am invited to the table, but we have to make a deal.
Well, okay, yeah. And we're really flattered that you came to this table first.
Yeah. And but if you're ever evolving, you could draw a group around you in some kind of self-realization kind of cult or something.
Believe me, they're calling.
I bet they are. All right, let's start. And on the outside of the industry, or at least not someone who's running a distribution company, how do you see this industry picture here as different from previous years which you've covered? What's different, and what are you noticing that we should be aware of?
I'm not flattering the man on my left, Bob Burney, but it does appear that Amazon and Netflix are major deep-pocketed players. They're changing the game, and they're in business with cash to buy things this time. More than ever. Last year, Amazon was quieter. This year, they were sort of putting deals. Last year, they were putting deals together. This year, they're going to pick up stuff. And there's an anxiety because the digital transition is really happening, and it's having an impact, and people are more concerned than ever about the future of theatrical distribution.
Okay, John, you're selling, is it 15 films here this year?
I think it's 37. No, it's 10.
Okay, do you agree with what Anne's saying? Is that
I'd like to see a little bit of that green from Amazon and Netflix. I have seen a little bit. But, yeah, it's an interesting, anxious time, I would say. Last year was pretty robust. in the deal making at Sundance, and now sort of famously a lot of those films underperformed. And I think there was some sense among the sellers that there was some buyer retribution later in the year. And there's wondering whether the traditional theatrical or all rights distributors are going to continue that here, or whether they're going to get caught up in a buying spree like they did last year. It's really, it's kind of early days at the festival, so it's hard to know.
Okay, just before Bob says something, we did not, Bob Burney, who has all this green, supposedly, according to John, did not pay us to allow him to come on this program.
No,
right?
In
right,
fact,
Bob?
He had to get permission to do it, which is a new thing, isn't it, Bob?
Well, we just let that, we've made Utah history and let the cat out of the bag on so many things. Thanks, Anne. Okay, so to what extent is what they're characterizing accurate?
Well, I mean, I think it's true about, you know, Netflix and Amazon have obviously come on really strong. There's, I think, kind of a big, some big differences in terms of theatrical, in that what we're doing at Amazon is absolutely theatrical. Everything is in theaters first, and we're the Amazon, you know, Prime audience, the streaming audience, really has it wants to discover films, wants to see films that have been discovered and talked about from the theatrical opening.
I think Bob's making an important point. There's a misperception, even within the industry, with knowledgeable people, about what Amazon's processes or intentions are. And they're much closer to a traditional all-rights theatrical distributor than they are to Netflix, which Netflix is much closer to sort of HBO in terms of controlling those rights and trying to keep them all strictly on Netflix.
And for me, it's kind of it's a familiar process working with filmmakers, trying to get their vision out and their, you know, working with them on the marketing. And so it's, for me, it's very, very, it's very cool because we're enabling us to do a lot of films and in a big way.
Okay, we're talking about a relative, this is something that's just beginning. The one film that some of our listeners might be aware of that's an Amazon project is Chi-Raq. Talk about how this fits into that plan and what you learned from its performance so far.
Well, it was our first production and our first release, and we worked with a partner on it, Roadside Attractions, and we moved the film up. It was supposed to be later in the year, later in the summer, with all the stuff going on in Chicago and tapes being revealed and gang shootings and across the country, all sorts of events with Black Lives Matter. We really wanted to move the film and put it in as a touch point and for people to talk about it. And it worked really well. The reviews, it was really a kind of Spike's return to form in a way. Amazing reviews on a lot of 10 best list, and you know.
Well, the Chicago Police Department helped you out by doing something bad every few days to keep the news side of this going.
It was. I mean,
Spike knows what he's
and,
doing.
And I suppose there was no Amazon Green going to any of those guys.
It was no. Okay. This was.
Just want to clear that one up. This
was, I mean, it was really amazing. We had a big premiere in Chicago, and that morning of the premiere, we also took the whole cast and crew and Spike down to St. Sabina Church in Southside and had a mass for the film with the cast and crew. And it was really, really interesting because the character in the film played by John Cusack, this guy's really, he's been there 40 years in the gun, you know, anti-gun violence movement, everything. So he and Spike were perfect partners to make this film.
Okay. How did Chi-Raq do in theaters, and was this what your expectations were? How did it fit into your expectations?
Well, it fit into our expectations of making a bold film and putting it out in a new model. The theatrical, we did a short theatrical in the beginning of December, and we knew it was going to be constrained because Star Wars, you know, was opening after that. So it was a trade-off of getting it in to tie into all the issues, and really, I think it worked, got great reviews, and I think in putting it in that context made the film work. And we're doing a huge push. It comes on Prime February 5th, so pretty soon. So we're doing a big launch, and you know, we'll see if people really work. But I think it made a big splash, and the awareness now for Prime is huge.
So Bob, it sounds like the model you're saying that still prevails is
getting into a theater first, even if it's a token appearance in a theater?
Well, it's yes. I mean, it's not token though. It's shorter, right? We want to move it quicker, but it's certainly not token. I would say our campaign and PNA was equal or bigger to the large distributors.
Make an argument for why a month in a theater is really beneficial for Prime as opposed to the Netflix model, which is day and date.
Well, a little bit just from our research and everything is that I think Prime, the customers really want to discover, they want films that have been talked about and discovered in with reviews and editorial and everything in theaters, just like when a film comes to a streaming service or a pay TV service with built-in awareness rather than, you know, direct to the service. I mean, Amazon obviously has TV series and Transparent that have done very well there, but this is a different model.
So are these films all going to be English language? Is there any room for foreign language in this model?
I think there could be exceptions. I mean, I think the main, as Ted Hope and Roy Price said, like sort of visionary directors are the focus and concentrating on U.S., but there definitely is always an exception.
If I could just chime in, one of the criticisms of Netflix from the film community is that they have not really shared their data about how many people are watching their films. And you guys, I think your whole model is more filmmaker friendly because you allow for theatrical and TVOD. Are you going to also follow that through when it's on Prime and maybe share more consumption data from your SVOD service?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. That's a Roy and upstairs question. But so I don't know. I mean, I think the idea is to be overall Amazon for the studios and dealing with you with filmmakers. It's to definitely be transparent in terms of our deals and how we sort of report. So. But in terms of the numbers, I don't know. I can't tell you.
So what's the advantage of getting that information? Why? What do you benefit? How do you benefit from that?
Well, as you know, David, knowledge is power.
It helps him make deals.
I feel weaker every day.
Yeah. You know, it's – I would say it's more diffuse. It's good information, obviously, to know what films are popular. And, you know, I think the argument – that the portals will make against you is that, well, if we give you that information that your film was wildly popular or this type of film was wildly popular, then next time out you're going to try to hold us up for more money or something like that.
So should Bob expect that you will disclose what you're paid for the films that you're selling?
My life is an open book, as you know.
So you have a big
premiere
tonight.
Answer the question, folks.
So Love and Friendship is one of – you followed up Chirac, right?
Yeah, our film premiering tonight at Sundance is Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship that John also worked on. And it's Kate Beckinsale and Chloe Sevigny who kind of reunited from Last Days of Disco. And it's really fun because Whit – I was talking earlier. I think Whit and Jane Austen, that's a team. I mean, that is like – it's sort of like you in the big movie posters. You know, we have the big just last names only. We were just talking earlier.
It's Austin?
It's Austin and Stillman. Yeah. Austin and Stillman.
How did Whit's last film perform? Did you sell that film, John, the last one?
Well, it was actually financed – it was financed by a company that has a deal at Sony, and so Sony released it. I think most people would consider it a disappointment in terms of its performance. You know, as far as – I've worked with Whit since Metropolitan, and he never makes a false step as far as I'm concerned. So it's – I think there's some head-scratching as to why it underperformed so much. Anne may feel differently. Yeah. This one
does Anne want to share anything with the class? No.
This one.
I mean, you know, we started with transparency, and now we've got these silent people behind microphones.
No, this. You know, if there were ever two people in literary history fated to spend time together, in my opinion, it's Jane Austen and Whit Stillman, and I think he delivers on this one.
He does. It's great. I think a lot of times at Sundance, there's a lot of, you know, dark stuff going on. A lot of rough films, and this is going to deliver fun. So it should be really, really nice tonight.
Okay, very briefly, tell us what the story is.
Well, it's Whit doing it. It's based on her novella, but so he expanded it, he added character to it. But it, essentially, think of, you know, Metropolitan, the way his characters speak in New York, in Metropolitan, it translates perfectly to period. In fact, we were saying we think we have a time machine. We're going to just send Whit back.
Well, I mean, he might say that between films, he felt like he was being sent back at certain points in his career.
I think he's been really busy doing that. You know, a lot in Paris, I guess. And
yeah,
he's been, you know, this. I don't want to look at it as a return or anything. But I think this is it's a great material for him, and I think it's very, very popular.
Is this at the Eccles tonight?
Yeah.
What time?
9:30. 9:45.
Okay.
I wonder, can any of you folks tell me, are we in the world now where, you know, in the old Hollywood days, it was, you know, MGM presents. Now it's a picture is preceded by about six or seven, the titles or logos of six or seven production companies. I think last year at one of the Sundance screenings, the audience started counting. Like the ball was coming down over Times Square, the number of production companies and financiers that were backing up the movie. You know, six, seven, eight, nine.
I mean, that's actually part of a long tradition from sort of European co-productions. Yeah. If you've looked at European co-productions since, you know, the 60s and 70s or maybe even before, you will see the list of all those companies, basically one from each territory who were co-production partners on a film. I think the idea that it's kind of migrated over here is that everyone is now so focused on branding. And if you have an opportunity to do an animated logo or a name and get them on the front of the film, then people are much savvier now and they take advantage of that.
It's gone from listing, you know, in the European to these long lists to an animated logo.
Yeah.
And so it's always, you know, it does take time. And it's always an argument, you know, with Josh Kramer and John talking about who gets one, how many animated.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's often the most exciting part of the film.
Well, it's like
we're back to transparency. Thank God.
Well, it's like that joke they did on Family Guy where Peter thinks the movie is about to start, but it's just the animated logo of one of the companies and guy running in the cabin or something.
You see, productions. This is going to be a short next year at Sundance called Animated Logo.
But you know, I think we all know this, and you probably know it as well because we're all sort of film geeks. But for years, I've sat and watched the end credits of a film because the end credits of a film are a narrative in themselves.
Sure.
And you can really tell who did what and how things came together and what the challenges were. And so, I you know, it's funny. It's sort of dismaying sometimes when you go to multiplexes and the place and you're sitting there alone watching the end credits. I think if you really love movies, as many people do, I really encourage people to stay and watch those credits.
Can you talk about some of the nuances to watch for there? I mean, so that you're not sitting through the credits just to see the little tag that Marvel puts on the end or something.
Well, you can see how many visual effects people there were working on a given thing. You can see all the film commissions and all the locations. Mm. That's the kind of thing I learned.
And which producer has more assistance than the other producer, and who the insect wrangler was. And,
right.
But beyond
Geeks
that, it does get an idea also, I think, that how many people it takes to make these things and involve. So it's also an appreciation
you're watching, now I hope I get this title right, Dark Knight, you can see that it's shot in Sarasota, Florida.
Right.
Or you can find out where all these kind of, you know, sightless or unspecific site locations really are, where people are actually shooting films these days.
And particularly for the people within the listening distance of this show, if you're an aspiring filmmaker, you can really decode how a film was financed. And that's really important information.
Okay, where in that finance picture, John, where are we going to be 5 years from now?
Right here.
Talking to you. Okay, that, you know, he's, you know, I
the
keep.
Traditions die hard.
Yes. Traditions die hard. But this is John's first appearance on a KPCW show. We invited him a million times in the old days, and we finally showed up.
Now he has a management company.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Okay, but
now I have to be nice, so I'm here. I am.
You're doing pretty well.
All right.
Okay, yeah, 5 years from now, what are we going to see that we're seeing the beginnings of that you?
I mean, there's a wild fractionization, if that's a word, fractionalization of where people are viewing content, how it's being delivered. You know, and to use another jargon, distributors sometimes are being disintermediated, and creators are going directly to portals, places people can actually watch their content. They're marketing directly to their communities. So I think, you know, the distinction between features and episodics, you know, length is going to become less important, and it's going to be more atomized. I don't see that as a bad thing, frankly.
Are we going to see new sources of capital, which will become major concentrations of players?
I mean, there's never been more money for the making of content in my 30 years than there is right now. Capital is not a problem. There are more very rich people than there probably ever been in human history.
That does not mean that the quality of the films is going up, and but to your earlier point, the theaters, I was at the Art House Convergence, they're actually, because the distribution mechanisms are still gridlocked a little bit, there's a lot of product, but there isn't an easy way to get it to the consumer. It still hasn't been resolved entirely. And so the theaters are actually going to festivals, seeing movies, and booking them directly. They're right. They're completely skipping the distribution part.
But there's always been too many films made. There's no question. For people who watch these films, we know that. And when 22 films open on a weekend in New York, there's no way any kind of viewing audience can sustain that.
Yeah, and when only five of them have James Franco in them. Bob, you ran theaters. You ran theaters and did okay. Would you go into that business today?
Well, I mean, you'd have to have so much capital to do it. I do think that, you know, it is about, you know, at Amazon, you know, it's about the customers and, them finding them films in different ways. And I think exhibitors, the ones that are providing a really good experience are going to do well. If you look at theaters that have, you know, increased the size of their screen or amenities or seating, you know, there's been a real change in terms of, you know, like the ArcLight chain, Landmark, AMC adding all these new seats. So to increase the customer experience, it's working. Also, I think technology, different apps so that people can find tickets and get there, just like, you know, just in the way Uber has taken over. Like, there are apps that are doing ticket sales. So if you provide the customers, you know, what they want, I think it'll benefit. If you don't and sit back, you'll be in real trouble.
Okay, we've noticed that there is a population that is over 50, over 60 now, maybe over 65, that grew up being accustomed to seeing films in theaters, that still goes. The films that have been made, what was Rob Reiner's film that was made for that audience? I forget the title of it.
Grumpy Old Men, no.
Not Grumpy Old Men, with Michael Douglas as a guy.
Vegas. That wasn't him, though. Leaving Las Vegas?
Nope, it was. Anyway, let's take it away from that specific reference, but the films that seem to be made for that that audience have not risen to the level of quality that would make anyone go to see them.
I beg your pardon. That's not necessarily true.
Well, there's a robust art house audience that is older. The question is, when do they get the younger people to come? Yeah. It's the young male demo that is the most compromised in terms of theatrical across the board in Hollywood.
Why is that?
I mean, we have a film at this festival that is arguably the only film at this festival aimed at that audience, called Sophie and the Rising Sun. And it played huge. It's going to do very well. You know, I think that those films have over-indexed in recent years. And, you know, films like Mr. Holmes, I mean, there are quality films out there.
45 years.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying that they're all bad, but many of them are. And many of them that seem to be targeted just for that audience are among the least.
attractive
to me. But
it's
like everything else. Whenever you try to target a certain audience, it's all about what's a film is really good within that audience. It's all these genres that take off, everybody might want to, get involved or copy or make. But ultimately, it's always about what films are really good within that world.
Yes, as opposed to, did anyone, John, was The Turbo Kid one of your films last year?
No.
Okay.
It depends. Did you like it?
I didn't like it as much as the people who made it did.
But Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, the big hit of Sundance last year, aimed at a younger demo. Fox Searchlight picked it up for a lot of dollars, and it just didn't perform. What, there's got to be a better way.
I like that film a lot.
Yeah.
Why,
yeah.
John?
I mean, look at Brooklyn. Brooklyn is a film aimed for that audience. Performed, it's the best performing film out of Sundance last year.
And a lot of these,
See You in My Dreams.
See You in My Dreams. A lot of these films for that audience are also awards contenders.
Okay, we're going to get
into the woods. Was the biggest.
Okay, awards. Okay, first. We've got Anne here.
Oh no,
yeah, here we go. Is. Okay,
I'm on vacation from awards.
Yeah, well, too bad.
Although that wasn't true yesterday.
Too bad. First, are you going to do 10 to 12 features a year? Is that still your plan?
Yes.
Okay. Wow. Where are you going to find them?
Well,
from me.
In fact, quite a few actually are from John. But at all the usual places. Obviously, the big festivals tend to be the places. But there's a lot of TED, Hope, a lot of pre-buying from scripts and financing films. But yeah, there's a lot of filmmakers out there, obviously, that there's enough.
Okay. And there's some green attached to that, according to John Sloss. Anne, come on. Best Picture. We're running out of time.
Three-way race, Revenant, Spotlight, Big Short. I'll give it to Spotlight right now.
Okay, Best Director. You guys can all chime in, please.
And Best Director is George Miller, and there isn't a God if he loses.
Well, we're in Utah. There's a God for certain people.
And we have 30 seconds to wrap up all the
best,
other traditions.
Best Actor.
Leo. No one's going to challenge that. The Revenant will win the most.
Actress.
George.
Actress.
That one is a race, but I think it'll be Brie Larson in Room.
Documentary at Sundance. We got to ask that one.
Ooh. Amy.
What do you think, John?
Well, I got two horses in that race, and I love them equally like children.
What are they?
Cartel Land and Amy.
Both good films.
And I think it'll be a dead heat tie, and they'll both get the Oscar.
Okay. First time.
History made again.
History made
again. John's first appearance on the show.
John from Synetic Media for his first appearance here. Hope we get him back next year. Film critic and journalist Anne Thompson and Bob Burney, film industry distributor, and like Bob Hawke, maybe a documentary about him next year.
Bob Hawke is screening tomorrow morning. He is a legend, and he deservedly so. Everybody should come see it.
Are you selling that film, John?
Coincidentally, yes.
Okay. Thanks to my co-host, David Darcy. This is Sundance Weekend. We'll see you tomorrow. And again, to remind, this is presented from Mark Miller Subaru. Love the experience at markmillersubaru.com.
Branding.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks, Ed.
I own an Outback, and I love it.
Pleasure.
Okay.
That was the Sundance Reel, Sundance on the Weekend with Rick Bruff and David Darcy. Rick will be back tomorrow with Stacey Domalski as his co-host. Thanks for tuning in. We've got music starting up right after NPR News.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You are listening to KPCW Park City at 91.9 and 88.1 FM across the Wasatch Back. We're also streaming live on kpcw.org and on the NPR Stitcher TuneIn and KPCW apps. If you missed part of today's show, you can go online to kpcw.org. We'll be putting our podcasts up as soon as we can. And we'll also have stories. Just posted something on our website and Facebook page about the Uber controversy here in town.